Coming up on Athens News Matters, University of Georgia President Jerry Moorhead on the challenges and opportunities facing UGA. Plus, our panel breaks down a busy week in news and politics.
You know, I've been around the block a couple times, and I have to say this is one of the stranger stories that I've ever covered.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ripley.
And I'm Chris Shute. Also today, new insights into violence in democratic societies and...
They spend their days looking at what the rest of us would think of as the sewage of the internet.
The human cost of content moderation on social media. Those stories, a visit to UGA Opera, and more coming up on Athens News Matters.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Monroe, Sao Paulo,
Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Chris Shube.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Recently, University of Georgia President Jerry Moorhead gave his annual State of the University address. And he joins us to discuss the university, its role in the community, and the year ahead. President Moorhead, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm going to start with a broad question, and that is, what is the state of the university as we start the year 2020?
Well, I would say that it's a great time to be at the University of Georgia. I think it's evident that there are many exciting things taking place at our institution. We're building a vibrant learning community. We work on that issue each and every day. I think we are attracting the very best students from across the state of Georgia and literally everywhere else. Our research enterprise continues to grow, now under the leadership of our new provost, Dr. Jack Hu. And it's important to note that our fundraising efforts have been extremely successful. We're going to be closing out our Commit to Georgia campaign on June 30th, and that has been our most ambitious and successful fundraising campaign in the history of this institution.
And as we look ahead, what's the biggest challenge facing the university in the next year and beyond?
Well, like any major institution, we have a growing list of challenges, but also opportunities in the coming years. And we put together a new strategic plan that's going to enable us to address our challenges and to take advantage of the many opportunities that are before us. Our plan has three mission-centered strategic goals, continuing to promote excellence in teaching and learning. We want to continue to grow our research enterprise, as well as our efforts in innovation and entrepreneurship. And it's important as well, and this is our third direction, that we continue to strengthen partnerships with the Athens community and communities all across Georgia and literally around the world. All of that is, I think, critical to our future success and our ability to meet the challenges of a major research university.
Now, 2 years ago, you announced the creation of an innovation district, and last year, those plans moved forward. What's the current status of the innovation district?
Well, I'm pleased to say we continue to make great progress on this important initiative. We think this is going to enable the university to serve as a catalyst for new innovation and entrepreneurship. This is an opportunity for us to transform our economic impact on a regional and a global stage. We took some important steps recently. Studio 225 is now open, and it's providing great space for our students to explore and launch new ideas. We've launched programs like Dog Camp Innovate and our new Faculty Innovation Fellows program. They are now taking shape, and we think they are going to provide some exciting developments for the innovation landscape at the university. And then I was pleased to announce a new initiative in my State of the University address, something called Innovate U, which we plan to launch this summer. That's going to be a week-long residential program for rising high school students here in the Clark County School District. This program is going to be led by our Fanning Institute for Leadership and Development, and we're going to be working with our high school students to help them on design thinking, teamwork, communications, all the while introducing them to the innovation landscape, and importantly, introducing them to the University of Georgia and what we have to offer.
Now, the university is a central part of the local, regional, and state community. How would you describe the connection between the university and the greater Athens community?
Well, that connection is absolutely vital, in my opinion. You know, for me, Athens is my home. I've lived in Athens and worked in this community for over half of my life. So the success of this community is important to me personally. And I think it's integral to the continued advancement of the University of Georgia. And I think we have to continue to look for opportunities to work together, hand in hand, to improve this community. And as we improve this community, we also improve the University of Georgia. There's no doubt that this city helps us recruit the best and brightest faculty, staff, and students to the university. They come here because UGA is a great academic institution, but I think they also come here because Athens is a wonderful place to live. And frequently when I visit with alumni and other friends of the institution, they talk about how much they love the university, but they also talk about how much they love the classic city. So in my view, our mission starts in Athens, and Athens is an important part of our mission.
And how is the university helping to build the economy in the local region?
Well, I think it's important to note that we have a $6.5 billion impact on the economy in general. But when you look to the Northeast Georgia, Athens region, our impact is $2.7 billion. That is a tremendous economic impact that drives this community. Over 470 local businesses do business with the University of Georgia. Our Small Business Development Center is providing training to help local entrepreneurs grow their businesses. And everybody needs to remember our faculty, our staff, our students, the visitors to our campus. They live, they work, they play in Athens-Clarke County.
The university is an institute of higher education. How does UGA contribute to K-12 education and helping prepare local students for life after graduation? I know you touched on that a little bit earlier.
Well, you know, there are a number of ways we do this. In our newly named Mary Frances Early College of Education, which we'll be dedicating later this month, we produce a number of highly qualified teachers and administrators, many of whom remain in the Northeast Georgia area. When you look at Athens specifically, we now have over 50 partnerships with the Clarke County School District. Our faculty, our staff, our students have a presence in every Clarke County school. They contribute through things like classroom instruction, after-school programs. We have professors in residence from both the College of Education and the School of Social Work. They're providing all sorts of professional learning opportunities. And then we have a number of programs that help students in the Clarke County School District prepare for that next step. Programs like our Gear Up for High School, Gear Up for College programs. These are just a few examples of the many things that we're doing in the Clarke County School District. I have to mention one, though, in particular, because it's something that was started out of my office a few years ago called the Georgia Possible Program. And that's a cohort-based program that takes Clarke County students from both Cedar Shoals and Clarke Central, and they are led through a three-year process, a curriculum that focuses on personal leadership, development, career exploration, and to get those students involved in the community. And we're attempting through this to develop the future leaders of this community and the state. And I think that's the sort of thing that the University of Georgia needs to be involved with, needs to be a part of, because if we can have an impact on the K-12 school system in this area, then we're doing, in my opinion, what you would expect a major university to be doing.
Well, once again, President Moorhead, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
As medical experts, scientists, and government entities continue to address the growing coronavirus crisis, there's another important aspect of the disease that is also creating thorny problems, how to communicate about the disease responsibly. Across the globe, journalists and spokespersons are grappling with the problem of being thorough and informative while not creating panic. Glenn Nowak is a professor of advertising at the University of Georgia and director of the UGA Center for Health and Risk Communication, who also spent 14 years working for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He says that communicating about infectious diseases, especially new ones, is a challenge for groups like the CDC.
It's essential to have constant and good communications because one of the things you're doing is setting, guiding, and managing people's expectations. A lot of times we think that we're trying to give people information. We are, but we're also trying to get them to kind of understand what's happening, how it's unfolding, how it could unfold, so that they have the appropriate and best responses. You need to get information out quickly to more than one audience. And as a result, CDC and other organizations are not just working to get information out through the news media, they're working to get information out through multiple channels, such as their website, such as healthcare providers, such as partners, people who can reach other entities, airlines, travelers, cruise lines. So there are a lot of things that are happening that are not quite as visible as the media relations.
But Nowak cautions, even though coronavirus is making headlines today, there are more realistic health concerns much closer to home.
Yeah, one of the challenges when you have something like coronavirus, which is new and is getting a lot of attention, is are people going to pay attention to other more likely health threats?
One of those health threats is the flu, which killed 34,000 Americans last year and over 60,000 the year before. Health officials say that if you haven't gotten your flu shot yet, it's still wise to do so and to take other precautions, like covering your mouth when you cough or sneeze, washing your hands often with soap and water, and making sure you stay home from work if you develop flu-like symptoms. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
I'm Michael Lahusky at the Georgia Museum of Art. We're an underwriter at WUGA. Having our announcements on WUGA gives us an opportunity to direct people to our website, freeinspiration.art, where they can find out more about our exhibitions and our many programs. We feel it's a great way to get our message out to all of Athens, all of its citizens, and all of Georgia. Find out how you can become an underwriter by emailing wuga@uga.edu.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley, and joining me now in our studio to talk about the weekend news and politics are Lee Shearer from the Athens Banner-Herald, Aaron Schilling from the Red and Black, and Blake Odd from Flagpole. So welcome back, everyone. We're going to start with the Clark County Board of Education. And earlier this week, Board of Education members and the Athens-Clark County Mayor and Commission held a joint meeting. So we're going to get a recap first. And Aaron, I know you wrote on this meeting, so why don't you start us off today?
Yeah, commissioners and Board of Education members met, and they focused mostly on two things, the population growth in Athens-Clark County as it concerns the schools, so like if they needed to change zoning and stuff like that, and then also about the work-based learning and career development programs that Clark County has and how they can get more high schoolers involved.
The part that I listened to most was about enrollment, which has been getting steadily out of whack over the last decade or so. And some schools have gotten supersized and added portables as people move into their neighborhoods. And I'm speaking mostly of Chase Street Elementary, while others have not grown or even shrunk. Meanwhile, we have a lot of new construction coming that's also going to add people. And the consensus seemed to be that rezoning is needed, but nobody really wants to do it because it's just always a politically and emotionally charged conversation because kids aren't going to go to their school anymore, different school and so on.
Most of the growth is happening on the west side. I think Cleveland Road and Timothy Road elementary school zones were the two that were being most affected, where they had about 700 new houses are coming to those two elementary school zones. Cleveland Road is the smallest elementary school in Athens, so there's some room there, but Timothy, I believe, is pretty much at capacity.
And there's also an apartment complex coming in with, I think, 1,000 beds on Tallahassee Road.
That's right, yeah. And there's a School C, which was a new elementary school that that the district had been planning to build is currently on hold. But it appears that, you know, that is going to have to be built at some point, and that's going to trigger a rezoning really all around the county, because the children who are zoned for School C are currently going to Whitehead, and that would take 500 kids out of Whitehead, which I think has about 650 kids. So then you would have to change all the zones to fill Whitehead back up, and that would have sort of a ripple effect all over the county.
Well, one of the things that Aaron did mention is that they were discussing the importance of an accurate count in the upcoming 2020 census. So can you connect the dots between the census and the needs of the school district? As you said, this is a lot of shifting if they actually do the rezoning.
Well, a lot of funding is dependent on our population. And so getting an accurate census count, we have a lot of traditionally undercounted populations in Athens, people of color, low-income people. Who are traditionally undercounted. Immigrants is another one.
Each one accounts for about $1,000, didn't Mayor Kelly hear it say?
$1,300 or something like that in total federal funding. And so, you know, if the population of Athens is bigger than what is counted, then we're not getting the funding that we need to provide services, and education funding is a big part of that.
I thought this was really a good meeting, and one of the reasons was that you had these people from the Athens-Clarke County Commission who are planning this affordable housing initiative and are trying to shape the growth of the county in various ways, talking about how this is going to affect the schools with the school people, which hasn't really occurred a lot in the last several years till now.
I was surprised to hear that they hadn't been collaborating in the last several years, because I guess I never really thought about it, but it makes sense that the school board and the commission should be talking to each other about their initiatives.
Kudos to school board member Greg Davis for that, I think. He's pretty much the driving force there.
What about expanding work-based learning, and how important is that? That topic came up as well.
Yeah, they just talked about getting high school students to get off campus and get jobs and stuff like that, and Commissioner Mariah Parker challenged every commissioner to get a high school intern.
From the little bit that I heard, I thought that maybe one of the limiting factors is businesses and companies out in the community not participating. Did you have any kind of sense of that?
They didn't give a good explanation to me of how they were recruiting the different companies. I know someone asked about it, and the director said through the Chamber of Commerce putting stuff out, but I think that maybe if they had better materials to go with work-based learning and had a better explanation of it, that more companies would do it. Or if they recruited further than Chamber of Commerce stuff, like actually went out and talked to companies.
Well, speaking of the Clarke County Board of Education, I do want to move on to a story that Blake wrote in Flagpole this week, which is the latest chapter in the saga of newly appointed District 2 board member Antoine Stevens. Blake?
Well, this, you know, I've been around the block a couple times, and I have to say this is one of the stranger stories that I've ever covered. But, you know, we talked about this briefly last week. Antoine Stevens was appointed to the vacant District 2 Board of Education seat last month. And the Cedar Shoals Blueprints student newspaper got excited about the fact that a recent Cedar Shoals graduate had been appointed to the school board, and started doing a little bit of research and looked in the yearbook, and he wasn't there. And that led to people finding out that he had not actually graduated from Cedar Shoals. And, you know, he didn't lie. You know, he said he was Cedar Shoals class of 2014, which I think is a misleading statement that most people would probably assume that you were a graduate. But, you know, that I guess that's there's a little bit of
isn't that what
there.
That means? I'm in the class of 2014 that I graduated with that class.
I mean, that's what I would think that it means. but, you know, that there were all kinds of other things. He had run for mayor in 2018. He said he had raised, reported raising over $100,000 and ended up not qualifying. And lo and behold, he has now admitted that he fabricated that figure. He did come clean about that last week. Looked back at a Tea Party conference that he had organized when he was a teenager. There was a police report filed by one of the speakers he had invited saying that he owed her $10,000 plus travel expenses. And I contacted her. Her name is Crystal Wright, and she told me that he had never actually paid her. He still owed her over $11,000. And he had said last week that he was going to make a statement that was going to explain everything, and so he made that statement, and afterwards made another Facebook post that said that he was checking himself into a mental health facility.
Another thing that the Cedar Shoals kids reported was that he had not completed his application. And that, to me,
yes.
That's about the board, not him. And if you have rules that everyone is supposed to adhere to, everyone should adhere to those rules. And that's on the board, not him.
Right. So some of this information was definitely available. Do you think the Board of Education members just didn't know, or they didn't find it concerning?
I can't imagine that they knew, but if they'd done a simple Google search, they would have uncovered some of this stuff that at least would have raised some eyebrows. But, you know, now that they've appointed him and all this has been revealed, it really does not seem to bother them very much. They've sort of circled the wagons around him, and I don't really quite understand why. The board president, Lakeisha Gant, said that he signed an affidavit, and that is their due diligence. So they apparently do no checking or vetting of any kind. They just ask you to sign a piece of paper saying you're telling the truth. But the more serious things to me is the campaign finance stuff where he just made up these numbers. I mean, that's a legal violation, you know, not paying the speaker. You know, these are crimes. You know, that's much more serious than, to me, making a misleading statement on your application.
This gives legitimacy to the fact that the accrediting agency is investigating the board.
Well, I know that this may come up again because I don't think this is just going to go away. And before we go to break, Lee, I did want to ask you also about the police review board.
The mayor, I believe, has appointed a task force now to come up with recommendations for a police review board. And that task force began meeting. They brought in people who have been working in police auditing and that kind of field for a long time. And they were basically doing a kind of a course yesterday and today, meeting with some commission members, but mostly task force members, about the pitfalls and potential of police review boards. It's going to be a while before they come up with any recommendations, but now they have begun, at least.
And a lot of communities have these kinds of boards, but the big question is going to be how much teeth does it have? Is it just going to be advisory, or are they going to have real power?
Yeah, I was really pretty impressed with the introductory course that they were giving, because they mentioned a lot of these pitfalls and the questions that they're going to have to answer. One thing that gives me confidence is some of the members in the board, one of whom is a UGA professor that I'm a big fan of, named Sarah Shannon, who knows about as much as anybody about mass incarceration and all the issues surrounding that. Cleveland Spruill, the new police chief, is also on the task force and seems very supportive, although he could find himself in an awkward position. But he agreed with what the consultants were telling them, namely that one thing that you get when you have an effective oversight group is more effective policing, because that builds trust, and trust in the community really helps policing a lot.
Well, that's our time for this week. Thanks to my guests, Lee Shearer from the Athens Banner-Herald, Blake Odd from Flagpole, and Aaron Schilling from the Red and Black. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
Every day, NPR's All Things Considered includes news that keeps you ahead of the curve.
If this issue is not important enough for us to draw a line in the sand, what issue is?
Plus, the unexpected.
The wing, the skin, the neck, the heart, you're making chicken meatballs, cooking the knee cartilage.
All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Every country, democratic or not, experiences a certain degree of violence. So is there a difference between violence in democratic versus non-democratic countries? And what different types of violence are there? Dr. Daniel Hill, an associate professor of international affairs at the University of Georgia, is here to answer those questions. So thank you first for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your article states that there are different types of political violence. Can you elaborate on this?
Sure. So when people talk about government violence, so violence perpetrated by government agents, that typically means military or police, mostly what they have in mind is repressive violence, if they're using the term political violence, right? So that would be violence that targets people because they are opposing the government in speech or action, or maybe they're perceived to be opposing the government. So I would draw a distinction between violence that has that kind of explicit political motive, right, that targets people who are opposing the government, and violence that just sort of falls into some other kind of category, right? The abuse is happening for a different reason.
So what's the difference between oppressive and repressive violence, and how do democracies experience them?
So in order to say something is repression, it has to be the case that the motive is to, you know, prevent or discourage this person from opposing the government, speaking out against the government or taking action against them. Oppressive violence, right, is, that sort of other kind of residual category of violence where it's occurring for a different reason. So the tricky part is that you see much less repressive violence in democratic countries. This probably doesn't surprise anybody, right? Because part of what we mean by democracy is a country where the government does not use violence to suppress, you know, peaceful opposition groups, rival parties, etc. On the other hand, there are plenty of examples of democratic countries that experience oppressive violence. Usually this is violence that targets members of minority groups, could be ethnic minorities, immigrants, for example. You know, in the past 10 years or so, there have been numerous reports, cases of this in the United States. You could look to other countries, for example, the Philippines, where over the past several years, right, there's been a really concerted effort orchestrated by the national government in an effort to sort of clamp down on drugs that resulted in thousands of people being effectively executed in the street by national police. Or you could talk about events in Brazil, say leading up to the recent World Cup and the Olympics that were held in Rio, where the police staged what were more or less clearing out operations in the kind of shanty towns, favelas, in the areas around the capital city. And the Brazilian police, especially in large cities, are kind of notorious among human rights groups for engaging in lots of this kind of abuse, right? Now, because this abuse isn't targeting, you know, political opponents of the government, we wouldn't necessarily say these countries are sort of less democratic.
What's next for this type of research, and will other factors such as public opinion and police enforcement be incorporated?
Sure. Yeah, there are a couple of directions we'd like to take it in. I mean, what we found so far is that once you get away from violence that is, you know, more repressive, targeting opponents of the government, there's not such a clear divide between democracies and non-democracies. So oppressive violence is, you know, in some of the analysis we've done, like equally likely to happen effectively in democratic and non-democratic countries. You know, once we discovered, well, democracy doesn't seem to have much to do with this, what else could potentially be at play? I mean, the reason people think democracy is going to serve as a check on this kind of violence is because it provides lots of opportunities for the public to sort of push back when they hear about cases of abuse. But, you know, I mean, it strikes me that in some of these recent cases in the United States where there's an attempt to convict or even indict a police officer on charges of excessive force or brutality, that a large segment of the public is sort of firmly behind the police and willing in a lot of circumstances to give them complete discretion over when and how they use force, even lethal force. So I think a lot of this has to do with say, if we're talking about the police, their perception of how the public is going to respond to this, which depends a lot on, you know, who the victims of the violence are. So I would imagine in places where you have a lot of negative sentiment among the public against, say, immigrants or members of ethnic minorities, government institutions that we expect to sort of function and constrain violence in democracies, they're going to be much less of a constraint. So, public opinion is one direction to take it in. You know, the extent to which courts kind of exercise discretion over the terms of, say, detention, whether we're talking about detention in like a jail or maybe an immigration detention facility, judicial oversight of and also legislative oversight of agencies that are responsible for detaining people in the places where they're most likely to become victims of abuse.
Well, I want to thank you once again for joining us
today. All right. Thank you.
Dr. Daniel Hill is an associate professor in the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia.
Many of us spend our workday in front of a computer screen. But what if instead of spreadsheets and emails, you had to spend hours looking at violent, hateful, exploitative content? And what if you had to do it for a little more than minimum wage, with limited breaks and mental health provisions that are rudimentary at best? This is the life of a content moderator, usually contract employees who work for Facebook, Google, and the biggest names in tech. Dr. Jonathan Peters, an assistant professor of communication law at the University of Georgia, specializes in internet governance and content moderation, and he joins us today. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's just start out with, what is content moderation and how exactly does this work?
If you think about the social media platforms that we all use, beginning, say, 10 to 12 years ago, they began to develop content rules about the types of user-generated content that, they were willing to host
right.
on their platforms. And so after you create the rules, which is a messy enough process, then you have to enforce the rules. They draw on artificial intelligence and automation, so they are trying to use AI to police the material that they have deemed to be objectionable on their platforms in advance. And then they also rely on people like you and me, users on the platform, to flag content if we would believe it to be objectionable under the rules created by the platform. It will be then sent to a human who will then review the content very quickly and efficiently. You know, we're talking about a matter of seconds. They leave it up, they take it down, they could suspend an account, deactivate an account, and so on.
So can you talk a little bit about the work conditions for these people?
If you were to compare the working conditions of a full-time social media employee, so somebody working at the headquarters of Twitter or Facebook, and compare it to the working conditions of one of these independent contractors, it is dramatically different.
Mm.
And so they spend their days looking at what the rest of us would think of as the sewage of the internet.
Mm.
So they're viewing videos of beheadings, of murders, of police shootings.
Wow.
And so we're beginning to see in some of the people who do this actual frontline work signs of mental health problems, for example, post-traumatic stress disorder. And it is not unlike the types of PTSD that would be experienced by first responders.
Sure.
Who might show up at a burning house fire or a terrible car accident.
Well, you did mention artificial intelligence. So how does the artificial intelligence side work?
That's a really good point, because some of these companies have turned to using AI more frequently. And one of the ideas behind that is to reduce the harm that this process, this industry, is causing to the people who work in it. Now, a corresponding downside is that AI is not as precise. And so AI can experience problems of what we might call under-inclusivity and over-inclusivity. And so if you break that down, it really means you are leaving too much up when you should take it down, or you are taking too much down when you should leave it up.
How much power to censor what we're consuming are we allowing these companies to have? Can you just comment on like how you look at that?
It's an extraordinary amount of power that social media companies have, and it is a different kind of power than we are used to confronting when an individual or an entity has been able to exercise power over our speech. And so you, as an individual user in the public writ large that uses these platforms, we do so at the pleasure of and subject to the vagaries of these platforms that are guided by principles that are not completely transparent, and practices, decision-making practices, that are not completely transparent.
Well, Dr. Jonathan Peters is an assistant professor of communication law at the University of Georgia who specializes in internet governance and content moderation. And man, that was just some really fascinating info. We definitely got to get you back in here.
I appreciate that. Thank you. And I hope I didn't scare too many people away.
Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
A strong community isn't born from the outside in. Instead, it takes people on the inside who have a desire to bring change. That's the philosophy behind the Neighborhood Leaders Initiative, a program that recently received local government funding as a part of the Athens-Clark County Prosperity Package. The program, overseen by Family Connection Communities and Schools of Athens, covers 16 different zones across the county in an effort to address wealth inequality and social disparities. Joining me to discuss the Neighborhood Leaders Program is Tim Johnson, Executive Director of Family Connection Communities and Schools. Thank you, Tim, for joining us.
Thank you. I love your show, and I'm honored to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you, Tim, and you are always welcome. I want to ask you how you would describe what Family Connection Communities and Schools does.
So Family Connection Communities and Schools is actually a collaboration. We have more than 100 organizational partners. And our goal originally was simply getting better outcomes for children and youth in Athens. That's expanded somewhat with a new partnership with Unified Government to also address needs of adults as they relate specifically to poverty. So we do that through a number of approaches. One is literally just getting people to the table to talk about what does our community need related to health? What do we need related to early childhood, to K-12, to post-secondary and career? And then we have a program where we have what are called site coordinators funded by the Clark County School District at Gaines and Alps Elementary Schools. And they work to help the students and their families connect to resources to address issues outside the classroom to help children be successful in the classroom. And then our Neighborhood Leaders Program, of course, has just been expanded in this very large partnership with the Athens-Clark County Unified Government.
Tim, tell me about this recent action by the ACC Marin Commission. It means that there's some good news for your organization and the community.
So the Marin Commission had set aside some money for what they call the Prosperity Package to address poverty in the Athens community. One of the first two actions they took was to approach us and ask us to really take our Neighborhood Leaders Program to a whole different level. And we're in the process of hiring 16 full-time neighborhood leaders. These neighborhood leaders will help their neighbors connect to resources to reach their aspirations. And so it's really a very exciting opportunity for this community.
You know, this is such great news, Tim. And you touched on it a little bit. What is a neighborhood leader? It sounds like a neighborhood leader, but there's something to this.
Yeah, so one of the requirements is that they have to live in the geographic zone that they're serving. Our philosophy is that you're much more effective when you're building community with the community instead of doing things for people in the community. We have a lot of poverty in Athens, a lot of challenges, and this is not about treating symptoms ultimately. It's about getting to root causes and really helping people reach their aspirations.
What kind of benefits do these neighborhood leaders bring for their communities?
There are a lot of services and resources available for people that people just don't know about. There are a lot of jobs in Georgia that require relatively short training and that have shortages. People have to, A, know about it, B, apply, and C, be able to get there. And so in that case, a neighborhood leader might connect somebody to the program, literally assist them in getting the application and applying, and then following up at the end to see if they actually got employed.
Tim, tell me a little bit about Changing the Picture, the awards dinner.
So we started this several years ago to recognize people in the community whose careers are not specifically child-serving, but who as individuals have spent their adult lives supporting children and youth in the Athens community. One of the many things I really like about it is the diversity of honorees. And I do want to mention the three honorees this year who are Judge Patricia Barron, who's the chief magistrate judge in Athens-Clark County, and then Dan Delamater, who's an insurance executive, and then Dr. Alice Kinman, who's in the Department of Economics and the Terry College of Business at UGA.
And tell me, speaking of the community, tell me how the community can help. I mean, there are various ways that they can help out with this dinner.
Well, the dinner will be Saturday, February 22nd. We are still accepting sponsorships.
Well, thanks again, Tim, for joining me.
Thank you.
Tim Johnson is Executive Director of Family Connection, Communities, and Schools.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
My name is Morgan Fry, and I am a recently graduated master's student in journalism at Grady College. The project that I'm most proud to have contributed to while at WGA is definitely the StoryCorps Athens project. I feel really honored to be one of the few people who has listened in entirety to these StoryCorps stories, and it really helps me feel more connected to Athens. Learn more about WUGA internships at wuga.org.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. The University of Georgia Opera Theater returns to the stage this month with a fully staged production of The Barber of Seville. WUGA's Michael Carden sat down with Professor Frederick Birchenall, director of the Opera Theater, and conductor Hillary Griffiths to talk about the show. Here's their conversation.
There's so much we could talk about with this opera. It is arguably the most famous opera comedy in the world, and possibly the most frequently performed. Tell us why.
It is certainly one of the top 10 operas of all operas that's performed. And last year alone, it had over 500 productions of it around the performances around the world. So it is it's certainly a popular opera, but as you said, it's considered by musicologists and by many people to be the opera comedy of all opera comedies.
And it absolutely is. Now, you have taken an extra step of bringing back Maestro Hilary Griffith for this performance. Maestro Griffith, thank you so much for coming. It's good to see you again.
It's a great pleasure.
And welcome back to Athens.
Yes, it's the fourth time that I've been here. And fortunately, I've always had this time period free. And each year, in the last 4 years, and I'm always amazed by the standard that Professor Birchall manages to achieve with his singers and his productions, the directors that he invites. It's really quite remarkable. And it's a really very positive experience for me to be able to come in from outside and give some input to the students. Just to the as far as the piece is concerned, there are some great musical highlights as well, and ones that people who've never been to an opera will probably recognize if they saw a lot of Tom and Jerry when they were young, or the overture. It was always turning up in cartoons, and this very famous entrance aria of the baritone. It's called L'Agua Factotum in Italian, but everybody who's ever heard any classical music will probably recognize some of this piece. L'Agua Factotum della città, largo. La 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 la. Presto bottega che la mangia, presto. La 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 la. What is it that is so special about this piece that keeps it from getting stale? Well, all these characters have are three-dimensional. They provide a great deal of room for the individual to explore and to express in a somewhat different manner.
I certainly agree. The characters are not caricatures, but they're so strongly defined that perhaps we see our, pieces of ourselves in each of these people and pieces of ourselves in the plot itself.
Did Rossini live to see the great success of this opera?
The premiere was not a success, but the second performance was, and from that point on, it was a great success.
I think it's very interesting. It's said that Rossini wrote it in 2 weeks, the whole opera, and he was writing operas one after the other, and of course the theaters needed them. The fascinating thing about him is, I mean, he was, what, in his early 20s when he wrote this, and he wrote, I don't know, 40 operas, incredibly successful operas. And by the time he was mid-30s, he said, that's enough. And he went off to Paris and basically wrote very little more for the next 40 years, spent most of his time as a cook, and lived a pleasant life there, a very famous man.
Maestro Hilary Griffith, guest conductor, Frederick Birchall, Wyatt and Margaret Anderson, professor in the arts and director of the UGA Opera Theater. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, and hope to see everyone at the theater.
Once again, the performance is Gioachino Rossini's Barber of Seville. It takes place February 21st through the 23rd in the Fine Arts Theater. For WUGA, I'm Michael Carden.
And for more information about the opera or for tickets, you can visit pac.uga.edu. And to hear an expanded version of this piece, see our website at wuga.org.
Finally, today, this weekend marks Valentine's Day, time for sappy cards, expensive flowers, you know, all of the usual tropes.
Unless, of course, you're single.
And that can be a real downer this time of year, but on Athens News Matters, we're not all about moping around.
So, our producers have put together a short playlist of anti-Valentine songs, some bitter and some empowering, for the single, the recently dumped, or the cynics who just roll their eyes at the notion of a single day dedicated to love. Here, then, is our list of upbeat songs for the downhearted.
My name is Megan Wan. I am a segment producer for Athens News Matters. The song that I picked was I Don't Want to Be in Love by Good Charlotte. And I picked it because I think it is the perfect amount of mid-2000s angst and like upbeat, get over heartbreak sort of sound. So great song if you're not in the mood for love.
My name is Gemma DiCarlo. I'm the associate producer for Athens News Matters, and I chose Train in Vain by The Clash because the lyrics are pure heartbreak, but the bass and harmonica line keep the song from being anything but plaintive. Nope, this is pure punk rock indignation. Dance away the heartbreak, my friend. Happy Valentine's Day. My name is Jessica Wurst. I am a producer of Athens News Matters, and I chose Girl Can't Help It by Journey because women should never settle for less than they deserve.
My name is Martin Matheny. I'm the senior producer of Athens News Matters, and I've been happily married for a number of years. So in order to choose my piece, I had to go back to early 2000s angsty Martin, and I ended up going against type, but this is an objectively good song. My pick is Fighter by Christina Aguilera. It's sort of a I Will Survive updated for the more modern era.
My name is Sophie Gratis. I'm a segment producer for Athens News Matters here at WUGA, and the song I chose was Forget You by CeeLo Green. I think this song is about realizing why this other person doesn't deserve you, why you're better off without them, and ultimately why they're not right for you. And I think that there's a moment where you can cry and you can scream because you still do love this person, but ultimately CeeLo Green is telling you to just forget about them and move on.
You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Martin Matheny is our senior producer, and Gemma DiCarlo is our associate producer. Our segment producers are Jessica Wurst, Megan Wan, and Sophie Gratis. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia.
Don't forget you can hear all of the segments from this week's show and our past shows online at WUGA.org. as well as on the WUGA app, available for Apple and Android wherever you get your apps. And of course, you can get in touch with WUGA on social media. We're at WUGA FM on Facebook and Twitter. Reach out, let us know what you think about the show, as well as any possible ideas you may have. Who knows? You may wind up on a future episode. For Alexia Ridley, I'm Chris Shoup, and this has been Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Thank you.